Melissa Martz will be our next speaker, speaking on a disaster and the tragedy trajectory explored through the Colorado Springs Traumatic Brain Injury Community. Melissa has an MA in special education from the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She's lived in Colorado since she was 3 years old and has called Colorado Springs home for 20 years. Living in the downtown area, she has developed a significant love of local history in addition to the lure of Pikes Peak. 10 years ago, her husband suffered a traumatic brain injury, TBI, and over the past decade, the couple has worked through many challenges, often finding resolution through long walks in Monument Valley Park with their dogs. She is actively working to publish her first young adult eco thriller that features teenage rock climbers, one with TBI, battling unscrupulous developers and acid mine runoff in Leadville, Colorado. Melissa.
Well, thank you. So Dave is just a great lead-in for what I want to spend the next 20 minutes talking about. One of the soldiers I interviewed through my work, he tried to interact with me and kind of bridge the gap between my life and his life by saying he was trained and coached that being in the war theater is just like living life fast forward, and that we all experience the same things that any of those warriors experience when they're out there on the battlefield every day, day in, day out. And I thought about that because he said, you know, hey, at some point you're going to have a car accident, you'll see a fire, you're going to have people die. And I thought, yeah, okay, I think we can connect. And then I thought a little bit more about it, and it didn't take long before I said to Sergeant Tyler Daly, I said, yeah, but I don't know that I'm going to be in a life or death situation with friends where I have to make a decision who's going to live and who's going to die. And I said, I don't know that I'm going to have to make a choice to actually kill somebody or be trained to kill somebody. So despite our efforts to try to come together and bridge this gap in our own community, it was a struggle. But we continued to work at it and share and talk together over many, many months and learned quite a bit. And today, I want to say thank you to all of you folks who are here. I think we're all nuts coming out on a Saturday and wanting to talk about, you know, bring ourselves way down. But I think that the ultimate purpose is to bring ourselves up and find ways to move forward and do better. So again, I chose this topic because of my husband. He survived a serious traumatic brain injury. And again, it's been 10 years. But through those 10 years, I know the struggles, the trials, the tribulations. And I had to say to myself, after reading Dave's book, which I read quite a long time ago through the Justice and Peace Commission, I thought, what are we really doing for this hidden injury that we really are not addressing? So I jumped into the TBI community and wanted to see what I could learn. And what I learned was this thing I call the tragedy trajectory, which is an interesting play on words. So to start us there, I want to bring us to a place called Predator Road, which Dave's, you know, images really show us. But first of all, I want to ask if anyone in the audience has heard of the Soldier Songwriting Project. Show of hands if you've heard of it. So I see about three hands, four hands go up. So I also want to ask, anybody in the audience actually have a traumatic brain injury or know someone who does? A few more hands, so great. So take a second and please read these lyrics. The Soldier Songwriting Project is actually a wonderful resource where Nashville songwriters come together with soldiers, wounded warriors, and they put their experiences to music. It's fabulous. But just take a minute and read through. And so for me, the lyric that really stood out was "The Time to Roll the Dice Tonight." And I thought, again, thinking of Sergeant Tyler Daly's analogy of life on fast forward, how many times have I ever really had to roll the dice tonight and wonder what's going to happen as I head out on that predator road day in, day out? And it's not very often, and I think it's probably really happened to me only once, and I induced it myself. So very different from his experience, in my opinion. So here it is. This is the beginning of really the tragedy trajectory. So what is the tragedy trajectory? So again, a trajectory, which really can imply a lot of things here with the military, as well as our own kind of experiences, but a path that a projectile takes under the action of given forces. So here we have these projectiles that are out there flying at us day in and day out, but also it's a path that we all end up taking, whether we're in the military, whether we're today here in our own communities. The tragedy trajectory has to do with kind of this recirculating of traumatic experiences that happen every day to those warriors. It happens to us at a varying rate of speed. I think our community at large has actually gone through some pretty serious tragedies that we've tried to, you know, move through and have some transitions, even recovery and even the grieving process. So this kind of explains what that tragedy trajectory kind of gets at. And this was where I was going to share a little bit about the life fast forward. But Dave did a great lead-in for me to talk about it at a different place. So who's really affected by this, and why do we really care? Well, so the RAND Corporation, and first I want to ask, too, who in the audience is actually active military at this point? I have absolutely no hands up. How many folks are retired military? Excellent. Yay. So a few more hands, and I'm glad to see that. So who's affected? RAND Corporation, they're the kind of leading organization that does military health policy research. In 2008, they released their findings that about 19.5% of returning veterans actually have a TBI. And it's linked to a TBI-related incident. This is about 1 in 5 soldiers. So of those 1 in 5, about 90% of them are diagnosed with a mild TBI, which mild, severe, mild, maybe that's just not such a big deal. So maybe we don't need to worry about it. But I can tell you, it's a big deal. And from everything we read about, you, I think, know it's a big deal as well. But I'm going to share a little bit more. Our Pikes Peak Area Council of Governments estimated just here recently in 2011 that there's about 85,000 military folks in our community. And of those, if we apply that 19.5% and the 90% for mild, it's estimated we have about 14,918 folks running around with a mild traumatic brain injury, this signature wound of the war. The Center for Disease Control, CDC, actually says that in a population our size, we should have about 1,200 people with a traumatic brain injury living in our community. So we have 1,200, or we have well over 15,000. So what else does this mean? So it's hard to kind of figure out because these folks, you know, they have forgetfulness. They are tired. Biggest issue, lack of empathy. And honestly, if you've kind of been around this, you really can see it's not just necessarily PTSD that leads to lack of empathy. There's actually also a physiological change that's gone on in their brains. And it leads to troubles with relationships and a disconnect with how we interact with folks. And RAND actually has put a cost on this for our community here in Colorado Springs at about $447 million a year. So a huge chunk of money could obviously be used to do other things. Or I can try to venture on the positive side and say, well, we're going to be learning great ways to interact with folks who could really use our support and really use our care and support. So who's the real guy here? And so Sergeant Tyler Daly, he actually entered the military at about 19. And on he went. So in 2008, he was on Predator Road. This was his actual second tour of duty. And of course, it's not called Predator Road, but he was in that place where he was, you know, lock and load, sitting on go, rolling the dice, wondering what's going to happen as he heads out night after night. And he had had many horrible experiences. And the latest one, he'd had a very intensive IED attack. And he was the sergeant overseeing a couple of other men at that point. And after the incident, he was finding himself falling asleep a lot, struggling with, you know, am I falling asleep because, you know, I'm just tired, you know, that's what it is. But then his commander, they needed to do some things, and Tyler couldn't remember where he put his gun down. So not a good thing. And so he was immediately referred. This is one of these things where the military has started to take some action and try to do some things. And so in 2007, they had actually implemented some field evaluation protocols for folks right out there on the field to get treatment immediately. So Tyler was referred, not happy about it, didn't want to do it, but he had no choice. And so off he went, and he said, you know, when someone asks for help, that means others have more work to do. And they were already understaffed and undermanned, which is another piece that we don't always talk about, but the military is understaffed and undermanned. So he was really distraught. Eventually he was cleared for duty. He wasn't allowed out for too long. He went back, served two more months, and then he came home. So when he came home, that's another step in the path here. So every soldier that comes back is required to do a post-deployment health assessment. And again, in 2007, on that health assessment, they actually added some additional questions that get right at traumatic brain injuries. Well, Tyler didn't know that, but he answered the questions somewhat honestly, and he was red flagged, and he was immediately referred to the Warrior Recovery Center, which opened in 2009, basically right before his battalion got back. So good for Tyler, but again, not so good for Tyler because he really didn't want this. This was not something that he felt that his military commander was really, you know, this is a good thing, it's great, let's do it. You know, no, it's really still a stigma, and he was still concerned, and this was in 2009. So at this point, the Warrior Recovery Center has about 1,000 warriors with traumatic brain injury. So my question is where are the other 13,918 of these folks? So Rand, again, actually has talked about the top reasons why these returning warriors kind of avoid help. And what they talk about is that 45% of these folks really are worried about medications. They're worried about them affecting their job. They also worry about it harming their career, which is exactly what Tyler was talking about. And then 39% believe that friends and family, all of us, can actually really make a difference. So what did Tyler say? So Tyler, he actually says that out of the men that he knew, and some women, but mostly men, about 5% of them ask for help. That number would be about 650 folks, so pretty close to that 1,000. So really, it's an underreported incident. He also really wanted his wife to be there for him, and he really, you know, he wanted to stay in the military. He wanted his wife to help him. So Tyler found himself going through a series of transitions. He immediately was put into the Warrior Transition Unit, which is basically the last unit that a warrior finds themselves in, a wounded warrior, as they start to transition out of the military. And he went through a medical evaluation board, which answering lots of questions, talking about all kinds of issues. Those reports actually go to Washington, D.C. for final review and evaluation. The Wounded Warrior Program, another resource that the goal is to, and they are actually stationed on Fort Carson, the goal is to help transition the warrior into the community as they are looking at leaving. And so 2 years, lots of hardships later, this was after, you know, this is post all of his deployments, 2 years, hardships later, Tyler was medically retired after 7 years, two deployments and a TBI. And then the interesting thing is, he was given the offer for a GI Bill. He wanted to give it to his wife, Carrie. And so the Wounded Warrior Program actually talks about 87% of the wounded warriors actually drop out of the wounded or out, drop out of their GI Bill program. So it's really hard for these folks to stay in school. So even though this is a great resource for them, for a lot of different reasons, whether it's, you know, being able to pay attention, you know, multiple things, it's hard for them to stay in school. So that maybe isn't necessarily the best answer. It's a good answer, but Tyler turned it down. And he wanted to start his own personal training business. A lot of these warriors are really physical, and that's what they like. And so he was on his way to do his personal training business. On the flip side of this, in the traumatic brain injury community, about 9 out of 10 marriages end in divorce. So as Tyler and his wife headed off into the community, they have some things to work through, and one of them is how are they going to maintain their marriage? So what is our community response for Tyler? So what can Colorado Springs do? What are we doing above and beyond once the military closes the door on them? So LifeQuest Transitions. How many people have heard of LifeQuest Transitions? Yay. Have a couple hands up, in the back included. So Tyler was referred to LifeQuest Transitions, and he found this program. And it's a great program because, again, this organization, which was started in 2009, they really work on empowerment. They really talk about combat veteran reintegration and transition. And they're really focused on the physical and emotional activities for the wounded warriors that can really inspire recovery. You know, these guys are physical, they need that, but then they also need some of the emotional endurance as well. And so they really try to bring in both of these factors. LifeQuest Transitions is the organization that was responsible for putting together the Soldier Songwriting Project, which I talked about at the beginning of our tragedy trajectory with Predator Road. And through all the conversations with Tyler and his wife, they were very closed about, you know, so how do we deal with, and Tyler, you know, he's, you know, 4 years into a traumatic brain injury, so he's still pretty closed. But when we talked about music, that just brightened up his whole entire world. He loved music. And my own husband even talks about, you know, quote unquote, music is the doctor. And that is very true for the traumatic brain injury community, so I can't speak highly enough, and it was wonderful to see Tyler just lighten up regarding this project. Another great resource that Tyler found himself in was The Mission Continues. How many folks are familiar with The Mission Continues? So I think one hand. So The Mission Continues is a fellowship program for wounded warriors, post-9/11 wounded warriors. Right now, there's 114 fellowships around the country. Colorado Springs only has two. And I work for Care and Share Food Bank. We have one of them. So in our very large 85,000-plus military, you know, population, we only have two Mission Continues fellows. And the purpose of this is to really bring, you know, the fellow into the community. So it's a tremendous program. Tyler really benefited from it, and other Mission Continues fellows have as well. So again, my question is, what's happening to these other 13,900 individuals that have traumatic brain injuries? There's a few things. So the Pikes Peak Area Council of Governments, they're at it, they're trying. They just released in December 2011, not too long ago, we've been at war since 2001, and they released the Peak Military Care Network. And I want to focus specifically on number four, public increase awareness about challenges faced by warriors. They literally even use the words that we have stereotypes in our community about what's happening. And I have to admit, we probably do. So I probably had some of them myself. So to bring about the public increase in awareness, this is a piece that they definitely want to focus on. And so I want to share another opportunity to bring some awareness through this Soldier Songwriting Project. So Tyler's wife, Carrie, this was her song. War is hell on my heart. And so I'm going to let you read these lyrics. So we've had lots of fun talk about all hail broke loose today, or, you know, the other day, but war is hell, hell on my heart. And so not only did her husband go through some issues, but of course the military spouses are having issues. Traumatic brain injury is thrown in there. And how can we possibly expect these folks, war is fast forward, you know, life fast forward, when do you have time to, you know, process and go through the transition, go through grieving? How does this happen? What do we do? So there are some things that I've kind of summarized here, three specific things I think we can really do to try to make a difference in our community. And one is to really engage in real dialogue with these wounded warriors. And we have a couple of retired military folks in the room, which is great, but we have no active duty folks in the room. So how do we find those people? Of course, they are athletic, and now we know they love music, and even some of them are really into art. Help the wounded warriors find meaningful work in connection to the community, really bridge that gap and figure out what that could look like. And finally, acknowledge this tragedy trajectory. Us as a community, I don't think we should be victims anymore. I think it's time for us to take action, which is part of what this is about. And then this is kind of the tragedy trajectory. So it is our drama unfolding on screen. And starting with Predator Road, a mix of recurring, recycling, horrible, traumatic events. But yet then we do transition into some health and wellness and grieving. And then finally, remembering that you can still have that last little hell on your heart experience, but we can make a difference and we can take some action and be part of a solution as we go forward. So thank you.
Our final presenter for this first session this morning is Dwight Haverkorn on the Espinoza Brothers, Colorado's first known serial killers. I know Dwight, he loves this stuff. Dwight Haverkorn is a 65-year native of Colorado Springs. He is a retired police officer and investigator for the city of Colorado Springs. Dwight is engaged in researching and producing local history since 1989, which contributes to the Pikes Peak Library District Special Collections Department. Dwight's index to homicides of the Colorado Springs area, 1872 to the present, is among the collection's most frequently requested resources. He provides a homicide index for the 4th Judicial District to the El Paso County Sheriff's Office and to the Colorado Springs Police Department. He's a volunteer at PPLD Special Collections Department for the Colorado Springs Police Department Historical Collection, historian for the El Paso County Pioneers Association, and Classic Chevys of the Colorado Car Club secretary and newsletter editor. He's a popular speaker who presents historical topics for Pillar, the Colorado Springs High School Palmer Alumni Association, and other venues. So, Dwight.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Dwight Haverkorn, and I'm here to speak of a family that terrorized Southern Colorado territory for over half a year while the country was in the middle of the Civil War. Although unrelated to the Civil War, it still involved the military as basically the main law enforcement for the Colorado Territory at the time. The Espinozas, two brothers and a nephew, have been called the Bloody Espinozas, among many other things. During their seven-month disastrous Colorado killing spree from March to October 1863, the Espinozas bragged of killing 32 gringos before two encounters with Colorado citizens ended their reign of terror. An event that began in December of 1862 with the robbing of a Teamster near Galisto, New Mexico, brought the Espinoza family into being known in infamy. Brothers Felipe and Vivian Espinoza robbed a Teamster carrying supplies to a store that was run by a priest in the New Mexico area. Even though the robbers were wearing masks, the Teamster, being from the Canales area of Colorado, where the brothers lived, recognized the horses the brothers were riding, much as we might recognize someone's car today. Upon arriving in Galisto, the Teamster identified the robbers to the priest. The priest immediately complained to General James H. Carlton, commander of the Santa Fe Garrison. As you can see here, San Rafael is down in the southern part of the state in the San Luis Valley. Today, it amounts to just about one or two buildings left. General Carlton sent orders to the Fort Garland commander, Captain Eaton, to arrest the Espinoza brothers, residents of the small community of San Rafael. A troop left Fort Garland for the very purpose of making that arrest. It was decided that because the brothers were known to the troop as troublemakers, that they would approach the brothers as being on a recruiting trip, and when they got close enough, would make an attempt to arrest the brothers. It was not uncommon for the military of the district to recruit new members to help shore up the Civil War effort. This is what's really left of the little community of San Rafael, is this little bit of some ragged adobe buildings and this little church. It is still in use, last I was aware of. It's very small, and it's quite old. It was built in the 1850s or 1860s. Everything was going well until a trooper attempted to grab one of the brothers at their home. The brother escaped into the house, where the brothers broke out a back wall and armed themselves and made for the near woods. Gunshots were exchanged, during which a corporal was killed and the Espinozas still managed to escape. After the troops had left the area, the brothers returned and found that the house had been stripped of everything. It had been stripped by the military because the officers and troops were angered over the death of their friend, the corporal. They found the house had been stripped of bedding, pots and pans, food, clothing, basically everything. The brothers were furious at the treatment of their family and later wrote in a letter saying, quote, "They ruined our families. They took everything in our house, first our beds and blankets, then our provisions. Seeing this, we said, we would rather be dead than see such infamies committed on our families." The next recorded incident involving the brothers was in March of 1863 with the killing of William Franklin Bruce at Hardscrabble. This is an area down south of Canyon City and near Pueblo. 3 days later, they killed another man, Henry Harkins, in southern El Paso County. This is shows on the map the areas of where from San Rafael that the Espinosa brothers traveled and where William Bruce was killed and Henry Harkins. Today, there is a little grave along the side of Highway 115 south of the main gate of Fort Carson, just a few miles down on the east side of the highway, a white picket fence, which is very difficult to see, but it's just a few yards off the highway. And this is what it looks like today. As you can see, it's not very well cared for. Several weeks passed before the brothers moved into South Park, where they killed another documented group of six men over the next few weeks. The citizens of Southern Colorado and South Park were becoming frightened over the deaths and the fact that no one knew who was responsible. Many theories were put forth as the responsible parties for these killings, possibly renegade Confederate soldiers, Indians, an unidentified gang, or just a group of ruffians. Nobody knew. The killings were all brutal and left no witnesses, but then the Espinosas became apparently careless. During the first week of May, found Edward Metcalf hauling a load of lumber about three miles from Fairplay, when suddenly he was shot in the chest by a rifle shot, which knocked him over to the load of lumber. The oxen pulling the wagon spooked and took off for all they were worth. Metcalf was wearing a heavy coat, and in the front pocket he had a memo book and some folded papers, which took the impact of the rifle ball. Some people say it was a folded up copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. Metcalf rose up and looked in the direction of the rifle shot and saw two large, dark-skinned males. Metcalf, unhurt, made it into Fairplay, where he reported the incident. Finally, the brothers were not successful in killing a person that they had attacked, and it was now known who the bandits were, but still did not know the reason for the killings. Captain John McCannon and a group of miners and citizens of California Gulch, what we know as Leadville today, were assembled as a posse for the purpose of finding these two unnamed killers. For several days, the posse combed South Park until finding a fresh trail of two horses moving south. The posse followed the trail south to a camp where the Espinosas had been working out of that would be just north of Canyon City, about 30 miles. The posse caught up with the brothers at their camp. As the posse was surrounding the camp, the younger brother, Vivian, had walked out of the shelter to an area where their horses had been hobbled. Joe Lamb, a posse member, shot Vivian, who died shortly. The older brother, Felipe, hearing the shots, escaped from the camp on foot. A diary was located along with several items that belonged to their victims that could be identified and definitely shown that the brothers were the unknown killers of over the last 3 months. The posse searched but could not find Felipe. This is the area down north of Canyon City where the posse caught the two brothers. As you can see, it's fairly rugged country. After the posse moved on, Felipe returned to the camp and found his brother's body left on the ground to rot. Felipe cut off one of Vivian's feet, dried it, put it on a string and wore it around his neck, and then buried his brother's body. Over the next few months, nothing else was heard about the Espinosas as Felipe made his way back to San Rafael, almost 150 miles on foot. Felipe was now full of frenzied anger over the death of his brother. He convinced his 14-year-old nephew, Jose Vicente Espinosa, that was his younger sister's son, to accompany him so that he could continue on his war with the gringos. On October 10, 1863, George Philbrook and Dolores Sanchez were on their way from Trinidad to Fort Garland in a wagon. They had plans of staying at Fort Garland that night and then continuing on to Castilla the next day so that Dolores Sanchez could visit family. In the Sangre de Cristo Canyon, the couple were assaulted by the Espinosas. Philbrook whipped the mules, pulling their wagon hard as they were pursued by the Espinosas. Shots were fired, which hit the mules, pulling the wagon, killing one and wounding the other one. Before the animals expired, the couple both jumped from the wagon and ran in different directions into the woods. Philbrook escaped and made his way to Fort Garland. Dolores tried to escape but was found by the Espinosa brothers, who caught her, took her back to a camp near the camp near where the wagon had been overturned, tied her to a tree and abused her terribly. She was left here tied to a tree while the Espinosas went looking for Philbrook because they didn't want to be identified. She was able to escape after they had left and began making her way on foot toward Fort Garland. At the fort, Philbrook reported that what had happened to him and Dolores Sanchez. The next morning, the base commander sent out a patrol to find Dolores. That afternoon, they located her walking along the edge of a road and brought her back to the fort where she verified everything that Philbrook had told the commander. Commander Lieutenant Colonel Samuel F. Tappan, whose patrols had been totally unsuccessful in finding the Espinosas in the past, decided it was time that these bandits were stopped. Tappan sent a man to the home of Thomas Tate Tobin, a medium-sized Irish man that was known for his abilities of tracking anything. It was said he could track a grasshopper over a rock. October 12th, Tobin, a troop of 15 soldiers, the soldiers' leader, Lieutenant H.W. Baldwin, and a young Mexican boy, Juan Montoya, left the fort to begin their search for the Espinosas. Juan's purpose on the hunt was to tend Tobin's horse on the times that Tobin would be off his horse and on the ground or on foot tracking. 3 days later, October the 15th, Tobin had found a trail left by the Espinosas because they had cornered a couple of oxen and were herding them through country that the oxen would not normally try to make it through, obviously trying to bring food to their camp. Tobin had the troops hold back a distance so the Espinosas would not hear their approach. Crawling for some distance, Tobin reached the edge of the camp and could see that Felipe was near the campfire and in Tobin's view. Tobin shot Felipe with his .53 caliber rifle. Jose, hearing Felipe yell, "Escape, I am killed," took off running away from the shot and had not made it far before Tobin was able to reload his rifle and shot Jose, also killing him. Tobin then cut the heads from the Espinosas and placed them in a gunny sack to take back to Fort Garland to prove that he had put an end to the killing spree of the Espinosas. The troops had been brought up to the camp by this time, and during a search of the camp, the soldiers and Tobin found clothes of Dolores Sanchez, along with her side saddle and several rifles, pistols, knives, as well as a diary and several letters and papers. After completing the search, the soldiers rode a few miles west and camped for the night. The following day, the patrol arrived at Fort Garland with the heads of the Espinosas. Lieutenant Colonel Tappan told Tobin that he had read in the Rocky Mountain News that the governor had placed a dead or alive reward for the Espinosas in the amount of $2,500. Tobin applied for the reward and was told that no money had actually been appropriated for the reward, therefore nothing was paid to Mr. Tobin. However, 9 years later, a local politician, thinking that Tobin had been totally mistreated, had placed a private bill before the territorial legislature that was passed on January the 1st of 1872, awarding Tobin $500. 30 years after his capture of the Espinosas. A second bill was taken before the Colorado legislature, and another $1,000 was awarded to Tobin. And this was the final reward that would be received by him. He was shorted $1,000, but did eventually get $1,500. The Espinosas claimed to have killed 32 men in their diaries, but the location of the diaries today is apparently unknown. So the documentation available at this time verifies the death of at least 12 men. Much has been written about the exploits of the Espinosas, and as new research is located, there will be much more to write in the future. More information continually turns up, and there are lots of things that have not been explored at this time. But finding information that's factual and not built on someone else's research is kind of difficult to do. And this shows the ones that I've been able to document. Thank you very much.